We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Keeping the Faith. My name is Don Nolan, and I'm a frequent substitute for Steve, who is out of town this weekend. And we have a very privileged to have one of our, if you don't mind my saying so, Carrie, local stars. But he's not just a local star. He is now a national star in higher education. Professor Carrie Nelson with us on the program. Thank you for joining us, Carrie.
Thanks for bringing me in, Don. It's nice to be here.
A article, at a short little piece, an op-ed piece, I think it'd be appropriate to call it, a op-ed piece that you recently published in the Chronicle of Higher Education is entitled "Keep Your Hands Off the Fierce Humanities," is the singular focus of the program today, and we're going to be talking about accountability and the assessment movement in higher education in general, and specifically with respect to the humanities. But this article is just a small sample of Professor Nelson's long involvement in higher education in general and distinguished work in the humanities more specifically. You are now a professor emeritus. How long have you been emeritus at the University of Illinois?
Well, 10 years, but I've continued to teach and be involved in the department. It was described at the time as a retirement on paper only.
Right. You know how to do the numbers. You just move the numbers around, and so it doesn't really matter, right, because it adds up. You were previously a Jubilee professor of liberal arts. And
still have the title.
You still have the title as emeritus?
Yeah.
And I take it that the number 25 books is no longer accurate. You've just recently published another book.
You can add a couple more if you like.
Okay, right. 25 books and 150 essays devoted to modern poetry, the Spanish Civil War, and politics and higher education, just to name just a few of the high spots. Most recently, you published, I believe, 2010, "No University is an Island: Saving Academic Freedom."
Due out in paperback from NYU next month.
Right. Hot off the press. I came across one reviewer of it who said, "A report from the front lines from the most influential president of the AAUP in the past 50 years." That's pretty good.
Can't estimate that myself.
You are also current president of the American Association of University Professors, 49th, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm in my sixth year in that job.
And those are two-year terms, and you were elected to your third term in
2010.
I took the liberty of just looking at the history. There's a seems like a larger number of University of Illinois people who have been past presidents.
We have had several Illinois presidents of the AAUP going back a while in time, in fact.
Is there any particular reason for that, or just a fluke? Just curious.
I suppose if there's a reason beyond being a fluke, it would be because the university was censured by the AAUP in 1963 And it was really a result, partly of that censure, that faculty became much more involved in shared governance work because they had to repair what was a broken system.
Oh.
And the AEUP chapter here locally played a huge role in that, as did several of the people who later sort of graduated to become national president of the AEUP. So I think most of those folks who became national president are graduates of the local movement to establish good relationships and procedures on campus.
And I saw that the first president is one of my mentors from the past. Obviously, I didn't study under him, but read him as John Dewey.
Mm. Indeed. Yeah, I was wondering how you were going to claim he was your mentor. But,
only from the dead. So this is a long and distinguished...
A man of some eloquence, shall we say.
I think so. Now, you have played a role in...
He also did our first, investigations. He was, very active in the organization back just in the early, 1915, 1920, that period of time.
He was at the University of Chicago at that time?
No, I think he was at Columbia.
Columbia. Okay. You have played a significant role, I think, from what I understand, in revitalizing the organization. You've gotten the membership up considerably?
Slightly. I mean, I think that's the hardest thing for us to do. What we have done is made the organization infinitely more visible. We have more than twice as many press notices as we had before I came on board. I try to talk to the press in ways that are clever enough so that they'll quote me.
So you're good at sound bites, are you?
Right. I've learned the necessity of that. If you have a good sound bite, then you can add some things of substance to it once you've hooked them with the sound bite. So I've worked hard at that and also worked hard at helping to create the policies that we need to create in a world in which higher education is really changing substantially and with rapidity that just astonishes me.
It's got to take your breath away the past 10 years that you've been president, all the changes.
That does, but I think more than anything else, I would say that it's the last 8 months that take my breath away.
Really?
I mean, first of all, you have, all of the legislative assaults on collective bargaining rights that – really start with Wisconsin and then move to Ohio. There was a serious effort in Florida, which we expect to come back when the legislature is back in session. Michigan has a whole series of bills that undermine public employee collective bargaining rights. That, there were a few politicians who mentioned that in their stump speeches in 2010, although not Scott Walker in Wisconsin didn't, but he obviously had it in his back pocket ready to act on it. So we just didn't – none of us really knew a year ago that that was going to happen. And I think we – none of us anywhere in the country anticipated that there would be such an organized assault on public employee pensions.
Right.
Which I – I'm a believer in solid, defined pension benefits. We've had them for years at Illinois. They're not so solid now as a result of what the legislature did last year. But that kind of thing has really picked up steam in the last month. And I think we've also had in the last year more press accounts of tenure that are critical. It's very hard to find a reporter out there who will write positively about tenure.
Right.
And a lot of them have been writing negatively.
Right.
So you combine all those things within the last year, and it's been pretty hectic. I mean, it's really been amazing.
Wow. Well, I just can't resist this one last thing. I think you must be one of the few professors in the humanities who have actually had a book written about you before you're retired, but you're not out of the scene yet. This is a book by Michael Rothberg and Peter Garrett entitled Carrie Nelson and the Struggle for the University, Poetry, Politics, and the Profession.
That was a huge honor, and there are some essays in there that for me at least were very moving and powerful.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's remarkable. I'll give you a little idea of Professor Nelson's background on this subject. Well, we are going to focus today on the accountability and accreditation movement. Much of what you've already mentioned bears on this, particularly I think it, to a large degree, starts with what you frequently see on the internet and elsewhere on legislative floors called the cost crisis of higher education, or the cost problem. John Boehner, before he was Speaker of the House, started to go after higher education and ask for more accountability as far back as, I think, 2003, 2004. And I've even heard more recently that several in the Republican side of the House would like to see No Child Left Behind expanded to apply to higher education, or at least to the undergraduate level. Where are those? How would you describe, from your perspective, those threats?
Well,
what is the account? What is to be? What is the concern?
First of all, of course, the movement really begins in K-12, right, where it has pretty much overtaken K-12 education, and there's a legal basis for it there in that most case law makes it clear that the state has a vested interest in what happens to students in K-12. The state's got a legal authority that it can exercise over K-12 education. Throughout the country, that case law, you know, although it varies, it's a relatively consistent pattern. It's gradually migrated to higher education, as in your time frame of, you know, a little bit less than the last 10 years. One thing, I mean, the only difference I would take with what you said is that while, yes, it's true that it sort of began as a kind of Republican Party platform, I think, you know, one of the few things that the Democrats and the Republicans both agree on at this point is that wrecking higher education is perfectly fine as a national project. So I don't, you know, there's not, to me, there's not much airspace between Bush's Secretary of Education and Obama's Secretary of Education.
Right. Barney Duncan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They seem to have really pretty similar attitudes toward what the goals should be for higher education. Mm-hmm. And I think the public thinks, oh, accountability, that's fine. Mm-hmm. Well, why shouldn't we be accountable? Of course, I think faculty members tend to be pretty obsessively accountable all the time. I think they think a lot about how they spend their time, what success or failure they've had in the classroom. They're monitoring their students all the time. And a lot of faculty monitoring of students takes place over time. So
much of our lives is taken up with testing and accountability.
But also just, you know, watching what happens to your students. I mean, I know a design teacher at another school teaches an introductory architecture course, and she says, sure, she gives the students, their freshmen, a grade, but the when she really knows whether she succeeded or not is when she looks at their senior projects 4 years later. And when she evaluates those, which are the culmination of their undergraduate career, right, then she says, did I get those design principles off to those kids? And that's not a test, of course. That's looking one by one at their projects, evaluating their accomplishments as individual student scholars, and it's reliable. I find that my most reliable evaluation of my graduate students, first of all, is when they complete their dissertations. And then, frankly, I look at their careers 10 years later.
You mentioned this in your article.
Yeah. And I don't feel I can really take pride in the teaching I've done in graduate school until I see a career that matters, that right, they've done something to affect the world and to affect their discipline.
I neglected to mention that this is a call-in program. We're speaking with Professor Carrie Nelson, current president of the American Association of University Professors, recently wrote and about to come off the presses a new book entitled No University is an Island, Saving Academic Freedom. And we're talking specifically about the accountability and accreditation movement. If you'd like to call in and ask a question or make a comment about our topic for today, or to speak with Professor Nelson, you can call 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455.
So let me say a little more about why I think, especially before anyone calls in, what I think the real problems with the accountability and assessment movement are when they're applied, right, to higher education. I think, first of all, it's the diversity of higher education, which is its great strength, that people passionately get committed to a particular philosophy of teaching. They try to carry it out. And a student moves from class to class and encounters these very different personalities, very different goals, and then they become really thinkers on their own right. What the accountability and assessment movement is looking for is uniformity.
And conformity.
And indeed. I hear it proposed that, you know, everyone in the department will have the same final exams and the same syllabus. And then for some states, there's an interest in extending that from campus to campus to bring that kind of conformity to all those different campuses. And that will kill what's, I think, American higher education's one of its great strengths, which is the kind of passionate and individually crafted teaching that each of us do. And the experience of intellectual diversity that students get that way. And I think, you know, there's an old saw about higher education that nothing that you can count is worth counting. Nothing worth knowing anything about can be counted. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, of course, students have to learn facts. They have to master facts as part of their education. But if all you do is test them on the facts, and indeed, if all you do is test them, you then focus on that kind of factual core, and it doesn't really help them. It doesn't test whether they're becoming critical thinkers. It doesn't test whether they're developing, you know, all original minds, all of that kind of thing. And we need that for a democracy. And if we didn't have a democracy, mm-hmm. then we could just have a very rigid educational program and, I guess, get what you want in a mm-hmm. country that's not based on freedom.
Well, let me read you this. This is a description of what is called the dysfunctionality narrative by the authors of a book, Why Does College Cost So Much? I don't know if you're acquainted with that. It goes like this. Colleges and universities have drifted away from their social mission, surrendered to the false god of research, and engaged in an arms race for more prestigious scholars and ever glitzier student unions. As a result, their costs have sprawled out of control, and the college degree, an essential entry ticket to the modern economy, has become increasingly out of reach for families with middle-class incomes. Now, the authors of this book don't defend that. They just summarize that mm-hmm. as the perception out there. When you said earlier that everybody seems to think that accountability or accreditation is good in and of itself, but that particular narrative of the dysfunctionality of the college-university system seems to miss so much.
I wouldn't disagree with them that higher education budgeting is dysfunctional. I think that there are, on many campuses, there are large-scale building projects that are unnecessary. Whether student unions are amongst mm-hmm. them, I can't judge. But, I actually I won't name the schools, but there are cases where universities have raised the money to build buildings and then asked people what could they use them for. I think you kind of should build a building when you feel there's a strong need for it, not just on spec that you hope you'll have something to do with it.
There is something called the edifice complex.
Yeah. I mean, people like to leave, you know, presidents like to leave a building or mm-hmm. two as their legacy. But I think legacies, the proper legacy is quality education. Now, the other thing that they say in that narrative, however, that I don't think is correct, and it's very common, is that funds are being massively diverted toward research and away from instruction. Well, mm-hmm. there are 3,500 plus colleges and universities across the country. How many of them are seriously devoted to research? About 10%. And without that 10%, the rest of them wouldn't thrive.
Is this true of public colleges and universities?
Yeah, 10%, about 10% across the border, seriously devoted to research. I mean,
the privates are about half the number of public, right? Is something like...
I forget the exact number. But in any case, taking the total 3,500, it's only about... the maximum number you could come up with of institutions that devote serious time and resources to research is about 400. And that's what keeps fields, scholarly fields, alive. It's what keeps them current. It's what keeps them questioning themselves. And that research does trickle down to the rest of the classes throughout the country and keeps them vital and up to date. And it's essential. I mean, I think we're spending the minimum that we have to on research to keep higher education alive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the other complaint you sometimes get is that faculty salaries absorb too much of higher education's budget. Well, the statistic that I think tells you the most about that is that 80% of the people standing in front of an American college or university classroom are earning $60,000 or less.
That entry salaries are what? I think the last I saw for humanities was in the $25,000-$27,000 range.
No, I think higher than that? It's 40s typically in some places and higher elsewhere.
Okay.
I mean, this June we pushed through a revision of the AAUP dues structure, which making it a progressive dues structure. And that's because a number of campuses that I visited, I would always ask this question: how many of the people on this campus who are teaching earn less than $60,000? Coming from the University of Illinois, I thought, 20%. Mm. Instead, the answer I often got was everybody. There's no one on this campus earning more than $60,000. So I realized we couldn't recruit members unless we had a dues structure that gave the lower earning people a break. So now there are some fields in higher education where salaries are really high. The highest typically is medicine. But what are you going to do about that? Engineering is high, but not anything like what salaries would be for academic clinicians. But they're often seeing patients. They're bringing in revenue in addition to getting paid. Mm-hmm. So I don't think there's anything to do about that. And, you know, in some places, business faculty are highly paid. Lawyers often earn more than in other fields. But because that's a small number of fields, it represents a tiny piece of the higher education budget. So faculty salaries aren't the problem. It is fair to say that administrative salaries are the problem. They have been growing, mainly because administrators set their own salaries, so lo and behold, they can increase them. And the number of administrators has grown at a much faster rate than has the number of faculty members. So I think, you know, there's space to see cutbacks in the number of administrators in many campuses around the country. That's a potential real area of savings.
Is the gap widening between administrator and faculty salaries?
Unfortunately, yes. I mean, it's very much that hourglass economy in higher education with, you know, high salaries at the top, low salaries at the bottom, and fewer people in the middle. You know, the last time I looked during Joe White's presidency, his assistants were earning $300,000 a year. And I would have paid them $100,000 to stay away from campus. We would have been better off. I mean, those are administrative salaries that I think are too high.
Once again, we're speaking to Professor Carrie Nelson on the topic of the accountability and assessment movement in higher education in general. And we're going to be focused shortly on the humanities in particular. And if you'd like to call in to put a question to Professor Nelson or to make a comment on this topic, you can call 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455.
There is a wedge issue for the accountability and assessment movement in higher education, especially in some states. And that is, given that the states have a right established in case law to take considerable control of what gets taught K-12, the wedge issue for higher education is what happens to the teachers that we're training to work in the K-12 environment.
Right.
In other words, does the state have a role in deciding what kind of curriculum they should be taught and how they should be tested and so forth? And there are states in the country where I just came back from Georgia, where it seems to be very much the case where the Georgia educational authorities are really taking a role.
K-12 authorities.
They represent both K-12 and higher education.
Okay.
But they're beginning to move into higher education and saying, okay, because you're training elementary and high school teachers, we should have a say in how you train them because we have this responsibility for the kids themselves. Mm-hmm. And, you know, part of what I said when I was there is that if you're going to have to introduce a degree of uniformity in your curriculum because the state won't let you off the hook, what you also need to have space for in your curriculum is faculty members who critique that uniformity.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, what you don't want is lockstep obedience to the state's regulations. You want an environment where the state's regulations can be debated. You need space for more independent philosophies of education.
Or what's a university for?
Exactly.
Well, in your short article in the Chronicle recently, I think it was August 28th, entitled Keep Your Hands Off the Fierce Humanities, let's start with this. What is it that you're afraid of? You in your article, you specifically mentioned the course that you teach, Holocaust.
One of them, yeah.
Poetry, or the one that you discussed in the article. Let's just be very focused and specific. What about that course are you worried about? Let's say the future trends that you're trying to buck or resist continue as they are. What is the concern? Or with you're going to be in the way, but let's say you go on, someone teaches this after you, what is the fear?
As much as anything else, that course is about unlearning as much as it is about learning. I mean, students may come to the course thinking that they know what human beings are, that they know what it means to be human.
Mm-hmm.
That poetry, especially stuff written by people who were in the camps themselves in Germany, Poland, etc., or by their relatives and by the generation that even if they weren't in the camps, they lived during that period of time. That poetry presents a condensed, harrowing, and unflinching view of human life at its worst,
mm-hmm.
and human motivations at their worst. And part of the point of the course is to make it clear to students that that's what's included in being human. It can be included. That there's no behavior that is too appalling for human beings to adopt. And so the course presses them to rethink their assumptions about what it means to be human. And I can't get to that by a true-false test. I can't get to it by a multiple-choice test. I need to get to it by people talking in class with great intensity and difficulty about what that poetry communicates. There's nothing I do in that course that's worth testing. There's nothing testable. I mean, ideally, the course should change people's lives. They should feel burdened by it. They should learn things they'd rather not learn. They should find the course haunting. All of those things, which I think address human experience at a much more fundamental level than a test can determine.
Mm-hmm.
And the test would get in the way. The test would destroy what we're doing. I need to respect their experiences. I need to respect the difficult burden that each of those students takes on in a different kind of way. And, you know, even worse than that, the accountability the apotheosis of the accountability movement so far in higher education is Texas, where what matters is how many students did you teach in your class? Well, it would be irresponsible of me to teach that course to a large anonymous audience. I teach it to a seminar, and I keep track of what's happening to each of those students who report that it is the most painful course they've ever taken, but they're glad they've taken it. And that's not a testable reality, nor is it a course that I would dare offer as a large lecture course. I need time to spend with each of those students and for them to talk amongst one another and to me. It's an intimate experience, not mm-hmm. a testable experience.
I was involved with K-12 teachers a few years ago talking about teaching Holocaust in the high school, and one of them mentioned very proudly she has developed 6 Holocaust module units, which I always found fascinating, that language of compartmentalizing pills that you feed at different times for which you can test.
Well, you could have a section on Holocaust photography. You could have a section on Holocaust painting.
In kits?
Pardon?
In kits? Teaching kits?
Probably not. I mean, you know, I'm trying to defend the possibility that a module could be okay,
right.
That, you know, you're sort of defining a specific area of cultural work and cultural history mm-hmm. in relation to the Holocaust, and that you could do. But I don't think I would have used the module terminology myself, mm-hmm. given the context.
This is a call-in show, and we're speaking with Professor Carrie Nelson, who is the current president of the American Association of University Professors, and has recently published a book entitled why do I always get the – fill me in.
No university
is an island.
Saving academic freedom.
And we're talking specifically about a topic of great concern to him and also the AAUP, and that's the Assessment and Accountability Movement in Higher Education in general. And we're going to focus more on the humanities. And if you'd like to call in to ask a question, Professor Nelson, you can call in at 333-9455. Or 1-800-222-9455. Well, let me be just an imaginary. I've been involved in assessment and accreditation and accountability activities before. And here's an imaginary assessor talking to you after you said in your article, "I'm interested in learning how their work and their lives have been changed." I know how you go on to talk about unlearning, but I can imagine someone in the assessment movement saying the following: if you know what change outcomes you want, why not pre-test and post-test? That would reveal how well you did your teaching and how well your students learned what you intended.
Well, that would require both the pre-test and the post-test reducing the course content to the lowest common denominator, to a series of simple, banal truisms that no longer have any of the real content and power to them. I mean, yes, I could, you know, I could ask the students before the course, "Do you believe people are basically good?" And, you know, at the end of the course, I could ask them to confirm that people are not basically anything, that you in a given country, in a given culture, in a given family, in a given school, you're shaped into what you are. You know, you begin largely as a blank slate. Okay, that's, I guess, you could ask them on a test those 2 simple questions, but what have you accomplished by that? It's the content, the depth that mm-hmm. that's brought to those conclusions that really makes them matter. Mm-hmm. It's the students' ability to talk about each of those things in their own words and think them through and try to apply them to their lives and their experience. That's what matters. So, you know, I could come up with 6 stupid questions to ask, but I would be fairly embarrassed to reduce my course to such simple integers.
And even if you got the pre and post configuration, it wouldn't measure the different ways that students took to get to wherever.
It wouldn't measure anything other than the students' willingness to parrot back what I wanted them to parrot back.
But then we could find out whether or not we should continue funding your course.
That's
we have a call.
I'll leave it up to the student evaluations
there
to make that decision if you want.
We have a caller on line 1. You're on Keeping the Faith. Question or comment?
Yes, this is Seth. I'm a colleague of Don's over at Parkland, and that's the only reason I'm actually bothering to call, since I don't usually. I actually am involved with assessments at Parkland, and it's not something that I enjoy doing, I must confess. But I don't.
What fields do you teach in?
I teach English,
uh-huh.
Which is at the community college, mainly English composition classes with a little literature. And although I'm in charge of the general education academic assessments, And our sense currently is that really the trajectory seems to be in an opposite direction, that really they don't, at least my sense is, and Parkland's sense is, that they're not moving toward the kind of testing you seem to be suggesting. Our sense is that really as faculty we're supposed to be just deciding what would be useful, what could we use to show some accountability, to show some continuous effort to, you know, improve our teaching, align our expectations, and so on.
That would be nice if it were true. And maybe it is true at Parkland. I don't doubt that it is true there. But, you know, I operate with a national perspective because I travel to, you know, 20 or 30 different schools every year and meet faculty members from many, many other schools. And, you know, just in the last year, I've been to several very large community colleges. I just came back 2 weeks ago from Austin Community College, which is moving up close to having 50-some thousand students in 8 different classes, 8 different campuses. So many of the community college faculty that I talk with are facing demands to have uniform exams for their classes, uniform syllabi. And I am also encountering in community colleges wonderful teaching that just is not compatible with an exam. I mean, I find right. people with great passion in their teaching who are doing very inventive and idiosyncratic things that I you know, that I'm just absolutely drawn to. But once again, they're not testable. I mean, I met a woman at Austin Community College who talked to me at length about a course that she does in popular culture. And she includes a series of experiments, like students can get extra credit if they don't watch television for 3 weeks and then report to her how that affected their lives. She gives them a series of...
Talk about pain and suffering.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, yeah, that's... I mean, I'm surprised that isn't illegal to encourage them not to watch television. It's optional. She, you know, she does other things, like she has them experiment with their diet, that they agree not to eat any fast food for a month, which, believe me, also, you know, is for American kids these days is quite a challenge. So the whole course is about
I'll
getting,
bet you there's as much lying about that as the dieting craze.
Well, there might be, but, you know, she's trying to get her students who are typically first-generation college attendees. Mm-hmm. They don't have parents who've been to college. They don't have home environments in which a lot of books are being talked about. So she's getting them to start by thinking about their lives and about their behaviors and their patterns of behavior, and using that as a kind of springboard to get them then to think more seriously about some of the books that they read. I'm not saying everyone should do that, but I loved listening to her. I thought, what an inventive series of things to do. And that's a school where they're worried about being compelled to have uniform exams and uniform syllabi. And I just think...
And where would this... Like, who would be insisting upon this uniformity? Because we don't get the sense that... the message we're getting from our accreditors and so on is that we just need to show that we're being thoughtful and accountable and so on, but we're not getting any sense that there's any attempt to impose uniformity on us.
Well, as I say, in the last month, I've heard reports of very strong efforts to impose uniformity, specifically in Georgia and Texas, which are two states I've visited within the last month.
By state legislators or?
Primarily by accrediting agencies, by boards of education. I mean, and there's a little bit of legislative work, but that, and in Texas, actually, there's actually quite a bit of legislative work in Texas. Of course, you know, there, you know, at A&M, they were compelled to evaluate the productivity of each faculty member. They, you know, how many students have you taught? How many essays have you published? How much grant money have you brought in? And then, you know, how much does it cost to have you here? And every faculty member was evaluated as being in the red or in the black.
At A&M?
At A&M. In the black, they were a profitable faculty member. In the red, they were an unprofitable faculty member. And then all these judgments about faculty members were put on a website so that everybody could see whether in terms of these foolish English accounting procedures, the faculty were judged in the red or in the black. I've always been in the red politically, but now I guess in Texas I would be in the red in terms of my productivity because I do publish a lot of articles, but I don't bring in money. And I these days mostly teach small classes. That's what I really love to do. It's my passion.
Seth, did you want to continue?
No, that's okay. Thank you very much.
All Thanks right. for calling in.
To follow up on the caller's comments, there is a distinction between qualitative and quantitative evaluation. I'm sure you're acquainted with that. And many who, when you complain about reductionism, reducing teachable moments and qualities in the classroom that you consider to be unmeasurable by bean counters, I've frequently heard people say, well, there's now a much more developed science, if you can call it that, of qualitative evaluation. What do you make of that move?
Well, my students write an essay every week. It's not a test. They write an essay 1,000 to 2,000 words every week. And then at the end of the semester, they write a long-term paper in which they do individual research. Mm-hmm. That's all qualitative assessment when I read that material, but it's not assessment that's really quantitatively verifiable. I mean, you know, you've read papers, you're a philosophy teacher, you know. Mm-hmm. You read them in terms of the content, the intelligence, the originality, all of those mm-hmm. kinds of things. And so it's not, there's no way to assess that qualitatively and come up with a sort of numerical result, which is really, I mean, there's no evaluation necessary beyond my reading them, talking with the students about them. The weekly papers, by the way, are shared with the whole class. They're not just turned into me, so that there's then a conversation about the writing that the students have done. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've always found when I do that, that the other students in the class are much harsher than I will be and make in commenting on one another's
papers.
That's
my observation.
And they're getting a pretty tough and relentless kind of assessment from their peers, which is, I think, one of the best kinds of assessment that there are. So right. It works, and no one needs to come in with a further measurement.
We have a caller on line one. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. A question or comment for Professor Nelson?
Thank you for taking the call so quickly. I wasn't expecting you so fast.
Well, thank you for calling.
So you better get yourself ready then.
Accountable to whom and for what? You know, are you the legislature wants test scores? What do they imagine that they can do with test scores? I would suspect that what they have in the back of their minds these days with the hard economic times is whether a student is getting prepared for a job and is job worthy at the end of education, but that's not the only purpose of education. Accountable to whom and for what?
Well, accountable to the state, accountable to taxpayers for public education. I mean, I suppose that's the model of accountability.
And what I hear you saying is that you're accountable to students and I think that's probably the highest accountability that we can have for education at all levels.
I agree. I mean, they can be a pretty tough audience when you fail. They're not really forgiving, and I think the real accountability in higher education is to two groups. First of all, to your students, and then to your peers. That is, to other faculty, and to the institution and the profession. That is, you're doing your best job for the teaching profession because that profession has a responsibility, not just to students, but to the country as a whole, to help train students to be participants, active participants in a democracy. And that's a different kind of non-testable accountability, the accountability to what the mission of the university should be in a country where you want citizens ideally to be articulate and able to engage with public life. You know, tell me I'm wrong, but I think we could use a few more citizens that have that capacity and can exercise it well.
What do those legislators think about longitudinally following students? That probably cost money, and they wouldn't like that.
I mean, it does come up occasionally as another kind of testing or accounting that one might want to have. It's pretty complex to do it on a major scale. I mean, I think it's much easier to do it when an individual teacher tracks his or her students over time and has some contact with them. I think you're right that doing it on a large, organized scale would be quite challenging. You have to track the people down. Where are they? What are they doing? I mean, it really is. It's kind of a major.
Alumni Association tracks.
As donors, yeah, that's true. I mean, I think, there are some times when I have darker thoughts about this. Obviously, if you look at the state funding of higher education, it has gradually declined over 20 to 30 years throughout the country. And there are states where the money spent on prisons, every dollar that's spent on prisons means a dollar less that's spent on higher education. The graphs of expenditures in California just are dollar for dollar over 30 years, increases in the prison budget, decreases in the higher education budget. So I am, and then also the pattern that's followed in so many places is that student tuition payments go up. And I'm concerned that there is a sort of political conviction that one doesn't want to educate the children of the poor, that it's better to just incarcerate them rather than to educate them. Or if one does educate them, all one wants is docile employees. You don't want people who can think, people who can engage in a workplace and really think about the values of that workplace. You want people who just be docilely cooperative with it. So I worry that, one of the impulses behind this movement is the dumbing down of education and, rather than the guaranteeing of quality, exactly the reverse, the elimination of quality, and also the elimination of many of the children of the poor from what I think is the only way to better yourself and move up the social ladder. I am a devout believer in the notion that higher education, and indeed all education, can change lives and save lives.
Years and years ago, I read a science fiction story about the need to save the world. And they looked for the person who could do it, and they wanted a poet. And there were no poets because they hadn't educated poets. They weren't useful people.
That's a science fiction story that may be a news report before too long.
Mm-hmm. Good luck to you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for your call. We have about 12-13 more minutes left. But we're talking this afternoon with Professor Kerry Nelson, who is currently president of the American Association of University Professors, and he's here to talk about a subject of importance to AAUP and to him, and that is the assessment and accountability movement in higher education, in particular in the area of the humanities. And if you'd like to call in and ask a question, we have a few more minutes left. You can call local number 333-9455. You can also call an 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. Let me just read a passage from your recent article, Keep Your Hands Off the Fierce Humanities. It goes like this: "For what I teach and what I seek to do, and for the fierce humanities in general, the assessment, accountability, and quantifiable outcomes movement is nothing less than a benighted enlightenment fantasy of mastering the unmasterable, of quantifying what cannot be measured. If you as a teacher want to adopt its protocols, that's fine. That's academic freedom. Just don't try to impose them on me. That is academic freedom as well."
I don't disagree with any of that.
Good for you. I'm glad to hear that. Once again, I can imagine a program assessor saying, but without data from your course and your students, we can't really evaluate the quality of education in the English department.
Well, my students fill out a course evaluation every semester, and the course evaluations on the my Holocaust poetry course placed me in the upper 10 or 20% of course evaluations in my department in the university. To me, that's kind of a sufficient register of the quality
but
of the course.
But do we know that real learning took place? That's one of the answers that you'll get when you make the student evaluations move. Do you really know? You can. Some have pointed out that you can, if you play it right, manipulate the responses that you get on those student evaluations.
Well, these are graduate students in that course.
Maybe not.
They're pretty smart, and if there's a way of manipulating them, I'm not sure that I know what it is. I teach undergraduate seminars as well, and I have a lot of respect for my students' ability to understand what they've learned and what they haven't learned. I mean,
but the legislators out there and the assessors are wanting to know if you really know what you know.
Well, the students know, and they're my clients.
We have a caller on line one. Question or comment for Professor Nelson?
Yes, I'd be interested to know whether this assessment movement is uniquely American, or do we find this in other places around the world?
It is a good question. There are different versions of it in many different countries. I think it is to some degree an international pattern. I mean, it threatens the humanities more than it does those disciplines that are more amenable to testing. I mean, there probably are some engineering courses. There probably are some accounting courses.
And the arts.
Where you can test. About 2 years ago, the AEP chapter here met with a vice provost who said, you know, we're going to get ahead of this testing movement. We're going to have a different evaluation. We're going to have every undergraduate senior sit down and write an essay in a room for 2 hours, and then we're going to grade those essays, and that will be much better. And there were only about 20 of us in the room, and someone raised his hand and said, could you mind telling me what sort of senior evaluative essay my dance students are going to write? Because they're into dance performance. That's what they're being taught. They're not being taught how to write. Then someone else raised his hand and said, well, I'm a painting teacher, and what kind of essay are my painting students going to write? I judge the quality of their paintings that they produce as graduating seniors. So
they should hire the philosophy students to write the essays.
There you go. That would work. I mean, it's surprisingly the kinds of education that we deliver for people with different majors are really surprisingly different, but they're designed to give those skills and those capacities and to encourage the creativity for that particular kind of work. And it doesn't transfer. I mean, what the painting students doesn't really transfer all that well to what my English students do. Those are sort of different worlds in many ways.
Further comment?
Yep, thank you. Appreciate the response.
Thank you for your call.
We have another caller on line two. Question or comment for Professor Nelson?
Yes, this is a very interesting program. I follow current events pretty closely, and it seems to me there's been a lot of discussion at the government level of problems with for-profit universities and the need to evaluate what they are doing for the students and whether they are worthy of getting student loans funded, et cetera, for these students to go to for-profit. And I think that's a much more serious problem than maybe some of the ones that you've been addressing, and I'd like to hear any comment you would have to make on this, and I'll just hang up and listen to what you say. Thank you.
Thank you for your question.
I forgot to say, by the way, in response to the last question, that there is a significant kind of testing and uniformity movement that's sort of grown out of Italy, and there's a movement of that sort functioning at this point in Britain. So that's why I think it is partly an international concern. But so I just wanted to add that because I forgot to say it. But
for-profit education.
I'm not a fan of for-profit education, as you might guess, and have grave reservations about the tendency of for-profit institutions to sell themselves as capable of training students for a job, and then so many of the students end up without a job but with a large debt to repay. So I'm, you know, I think that's really a corrupt form of marketing, and that, you know, more legislation and more supervision is needed to block it. That said, you know, why do the for-profit schools succeed at all? And I think it is in part because there is a segment of the American society at this point that thinks education should be job training and that's it. You should go to higher education and you should learn how to do a job and then that's it. My response to that is threefold. First of all, far too many Americans end up in jobs for their lives that they don't like. I mean, they end up in jobs that, in fact, do not leave them happy at work. I'm lucky enough to have a job that I really enjoy. And so I can say, you mean I actually got paid for teaching that class? I mean, that, you know, it's a life that I think you can really feel good about. But many Americans have jobs they don't like. So I think job training as a part of higher education is valuable and important. But I think my second point would be that you need to let students get a glimpse of what work is really like, not simply train for a job that they may in fact end up hating. They need to understand more deeply what it means if a job means going somewhere from 9 to 5, if a job means taking orders, things, none of which things, by the way, I found that I could do very well. I can work long hours as long as I've assigned myself the task. I'm not very good at taking an order from someone else about working hard from 9 to 5. So I think, you know, there's a kind of depth of understanding of what work is that requires studying American culture more broadly than you'll get in a for-profit, narrowly job-training institution. So I think, the risk is that students will be misled about what their lives will be like by narrow job training, and I think that's really quite tragic. And finally, the other thing I'd say about for-profit education is that whether a given student likes it or not, higher education should be helping people become more effective citizens. They should learn about the country's history. They should learn how to evaluate legislation. They should learn to listen to politicians' speeches and be able to critique them carefully. I mean, we're trying to set a model, I think, of what it means to be a citizen by the kind of training that we do.
The Jeffersonian ideal.
Yeah, and that, too, is not encompassed by for-profit education. So, you know, for all those reasons, exploiting students, leaving them with debt rather than a form of employment, and missing the higher functions of higher education, the broader public social responsibilities of higher education, I think the for-profit sector depresses me and disappoints me. But it's growing, and it's, you know, I think there is more oversight that's moving through Congress in the last year, particularly oversight of those for-profit institutions that sell a future that they're not really delivering to students.
There's actually been several challenges to funding for those institutions from the government, as
yeah.
I understand it,
and
in Congress.
You know, seems to me welcome.
For those who might be interested in this topic of for-profit education, particularly higher education, we interviewed on this program Martha Nussbaum some months ago, and she just recently published a book called Not For Profit, Why Education, I forget the subtitle, Needs Democracy or something to that effect.
Considering that I've read the book, I should know the subtitle, but I don't remember it either.
Same here, and I interviewed her. It's on the archives of Keeping the Faith if you would like to look that up. Martha Nussbaum's book, Not For Profit. Well, we just are almost out of time here, Carrie. Thank you very much for joining us. It's a stimulating conversation.
Thanks for having me in. I've enjoyed it.
Wish we could have continued it a lot longer. There's so many other avenues and topics to pursue. And good luck in your sixth term. Are you term limited or is this your last
term? I'm term limited, June 2012.
I've been talking to Professor Carrie Nelson, president of the AAUP, on the subject of the accountability and assessment movement. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith. Good night.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580.
Annetta Brodsky, a deaf teen living in New York City, discovers the power of American Sign Language poetry as she prepares to be one of the first deaf poets to compete in a youth poetry slam. Our next community cinema, Deaf Jam, follows her journey leading to an unexpected collaboration. The free public screening is at the Maine Champaign Public Library, Tuesday, October 4th, from 6 to 8:30 p.m. The film is closed captioned and the discussion translated by a sign language interpreter.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580